Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's an age-old debate whether animals have any real sense of reality or are they essentially organic machines with no real awareness. Biologists, psychologists, and behaviorists, to name a few key players in the debate, tend to support the thesis that animals are incapable of, heaven forbid, things like compassion, sorrow, grieving, and joy. After all, to have such would imply complex thinking. And then, there are those who tell a different story. Living with wolves can make a difference. We continue this special edition of Your Voice of the Earth when the Wild Side News continues.
Wolves. Probably one of the most interesting and fascinating creatures throughout all time. Many cultures have been focused around wolves, certainly the Native Americans, as well as Egyptians and others have been fascinated with wolves for a lot of reasons. Obviously, the wolf has kind of morphed into what we know as our dogs, and for people who know about dogs and have had a chance to really befriend dogs, there is a bond between human and dog that is unique within the animal species. To tell us more about that, we're continuing our conversation with Jim and Jamie Dutcher, who have their new book out called Living with Wolves, which is a companion to their Discovery Channel film of the same name, Living with Wolves, and they're joining us from Ketchum, Idaho. Hey, what's it like today in Ketchum?
But just about to snow, I think. It's late autumn, yeah, so it won't be long.
Your effort was to film and photograph the social lives of wolves. That was really the focus of your work, to try to understand better the nature of the wolf and as well the nature of the pack. And so in that process, you literally became, I like to think of it as embedded in the wolf pack.
That's a very good way to put it.
as reporters. And that's kind of what you did. Your job was to witness and be part of it without taking the lead. One of the things that's fascinating about wolves is the fact that they are so different. You have an alpha male, alpha female, you have a beta male and female, and ultimately the low-ranking wolf in a pack are the omega creatures. Let's start with the alpha male, alpha female relationship. And after this much time that you've spent with the wolves, what you've come to know about the alpha male, alpha female?
Because wolves are individuals as well as part of the pack, you have to remember that from pack to pack, things will vary. What we see in our alpha, you may not see in another alpha. We found the alpha male in our pack to be an incredibly benevolent, caring leader. He was not overly aggressive. He would assert himself when he had to, especially when the wolves were feeding. He was the one who decided who was going to eat first, who was going to eat last, and everything in between, and he would pretty much oversee that. He was always the first to be alerted to any strange sounds or something, you know, going on outside the territory. And he also is the only wolf to breed. Usually in a wolf pack, only the alpha male and females will breed unless, you know, other dynamics are going on, if prey is really plentiful and the pack is small. The alpha might also breed with a beta female or allow a beta male to breed. But that's really what we saw with the alpha male. And the alpha female is a completely different story. She is a tough broad. Our alpha female started off, we thought, in puppyhood. We thought she was destined to be the omega. She was very shy. She was always getting picked on. And, you know, you cannot predict, you know, how wolf behavior is going to turn out. And it's like a little light went off in her head one day. And she decided this was not for her. She was not going to be the omega. And she suddenly became much more aggressive and started putting down the other female of the same age in the pack. And pretty much, you know, put herself out there to the alpha male going, hey, it's me, you're picking me.
Would some of those disputes with the other females become intense? I mean, was it really kind of a true fight of sorts?
It could be at times. The you know, breeding rights are a pretty major deal for wolves and other animals. And basically, what the alpha female does is makes it virtually impossible for the other females to breed by attacking their genital areas. So it becomes painful. So if another female is approached by a male, she'll quickly sit herself down in the snow and it's like, no thanks.
Interesting.
So it's not pretty, but it works.
A lot of people wonder why it is that the wolves should be arranged in this hierarchy, but they are a hunting animal. That is what they do. They hunt, they find a prey, and I guess through time it was just determined that someone had to be a leader.
Absolutely. It's they work completely as a team.
It's this cooperation, the intelligence that this animal has, and it makes it very different from cougars and bears that hunt by themselves. The bear and the cougar, they have the strength to break the back of a elk, but wolves can't do that. They don't have those kind of tools, that kind of strength. So they use their cooperation to survive.
In a hunt, is it the alpha that would then sort of determine which animal? Because if you have, let's say, a herd of elk, they may track those animals for days, watching them. They may have had fed before and didn't need to eat, but when it was time again, then they would have to literally choose an animal. Now, there's a lot of apparent intelligence going on there.
Right. The alpha male is usually a heavier animal, and the females are slighter. They're almost the size of coyotes, and sometimes mistaken for coyotes. And the females would be out in front, kind of zigzagging back and forth as they're chasing caribou or elk, trying to confuse the herd, where the larger alphas or the larger males would probably bring down the animals. It's this cooperation and thinking, and they have different techniques. Like in the summertime, they may run caribou over a river bottom or riparian area where there's a lot of river rocks, and the caribou would stumble and break their legs, and that would be an opportunity. In the winter, like with caribou, the caribou all in a line in the deep snow, and the last caribou would have this wolf sort of chasing and, you know, snapping at its legs and get nervous, and everything's fine if they stay in this trail, but they would panic, and they'd jump into the deeper snow, and then the pack would jump on the floundering ungulate and kill it.
You know, one of the things that you had the great fortune and wisdom to do in the process of filming these, you were able to analyze some of these films by slowing down the images, and you began to discern that there was a lot of subliminal, for us it would appear subliminal, for them it's direct, but anyway, communication that's happening that we may not be aware of. I think that's so fascinating.
Oh.
And then the sense that these animals are communicating all the time.
They really are. It's you know, people, when they generally think of wolves or a wolf pack, they obviously think of howling. That's the most popular scenario. But besides the howling and the whining and the yips and all this verbal communication, there is so much physical communication going on with touching and body posture and, you know, just the tilt of the head, and it's very, very subtle. And by being able to slow down the footage, you could really see entirely new stories that were going on that you never would have caught before.
Give us an idea of some of those things. I'm naturally an ethologist. I'm fascinated with animal behavior. So tell me some of the discoveries.
The bottom of the pack, we've talked about the alphas. There's the omega, and this wolf gets to eat last. He's often picked upon, and our omega was actually the brother of the alpha, and surprisingly, our omega was a little bit bigger than his brother, the alpha, but it seems to be in their genes just to be followers. They're often picked upon, and sort of like a kindergarten playground. You can sort of see this kind of behavior in children as you do with wolves. But with our omega in Lakota would always be picked on. There was one wolf in the family, in the pack, that seemed to befriend Lakota. And this was the Motsi. He was the beta wolf, second in command. And for some reason, he always enjoyed being with the Lakota, the Omega. He would befriend them. They would go off together. We would see sometimes when other wolves were picking on the Omega, Motsi, the beta wolf, would actually body check, get in between the fight and protect this friend of his. And so we could see that there were different personalities in this pack, but also different friendships.
Yeah, and this was, you know, when you were filming it, you're just seeing kind of this frenzy of wolves and you know, this mid-ranking wolf picking on the Omega wolf. But then, you know, you'd go back, or you'd be watching, and it's like, you know, there's something going on here, and you'd slow it down, and you'd realize that Motsi, you know, had actually inserted himself in between the Omega and one of the mid-ranking wolves and just broke it up, allowing Lakota to get away and sort of changing the subject. And it was, we never would have seen that otherwise if we really hadn't slowed the film down.
As a pack of animals that hunt, hunting has to be done to a large degree in stealth. Until a certain point where that's no longer an important thing. But I'm curious your observations about how much they sort of relied on body languaging versus vocalizations to communicate in the hunt and in their socialization as a pack.
It's a lot of body language. You know, a lot of tilts of the head, ears back, just the way they're moving, if it's close to the ground or more upright. They would whine quietly to each other. It's, you know, usually when you, if you're lucky enough to see wolves, for instance, in Alaska or even Yellowstone now, of course you can see them, wolves will just follow a herd. You know, they'll just be trotting along, looking at each other and looking at the herd, and they take their time. They take their time and wait. Unlike, you know, a cougar, that might be hiding in the bushes and stealthily stalking. Wolves will be very casual about it, and then when they find their opportunity, that's when they go in.
Most people are aware of this, but I think it's important to reinforce the idea that actually, while they're tracking these herds, they're watching the creatures, and one of their jobs in nature is to cull out the weak or the infirm or the old.
Absolutely.
People who have dogs, one of the reasons I think that dogs and humans have bonded so closely is the fact that they read us. Our body language and their languaging through body postures, etc., are very, very similar. We have the eyes in the front of our head. We can communicate across a room all sorts of things just with our eyes or our eyebrows, the tilt of our head. As you were interacting with these wolves, what sort of communications you were able to discern that you felt were very close to our own?
During the feeding process, when they would be on a carcass, there was an awful lot of language going back and forth from pack members, and the alpha would dominate the food, and he would decide who got to eat and when, and he would just with vocalizations and growls and snarls, pulling back the flesh on his mouth and showing these fangs and snapping. And it was, he would jump on another wolf if the wolf got too close to the carcass, but there was never really any blood involved. It was mostly just a language of going. And so he would stare at another wolf and just raise his fangs and his "Arr!" And that would be a signal for the other wolf to stay away. But there were other subtle languages that went on between the wolves, and whimpers and whines, and it was amazing. Every day we saw something different. Each wolf was so different than the other, the personalities, the characteristics, and the coloring. You know, it's an amazing animal. When you take chimpanzees and dolphins and such, they somewhat look the same. Well, wolves, each one stood out from the other.
And it's interesting, you know, what you were saying, Sydney, about, you know, how dogs can read us. And it is the same way with wolves. They seem to be the only animals that know what we're thinking. We really are such similar creatures. The way they show compassion and care for each other, the way they take care of each other. It's, I mean, you know, Jim was talking about the wolves on the carcass. We saw something that was really quite funny. one time. We had fed the wolves. They had eaten a large carcass, and somebody had brought us actually a fawn carcass, and we weren't able to freeze it. So we thought, okay, well, you know, the wolves have already left, but we'll go ahead and give it to them. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't much of a meal. It was more like a, you know, just a little treat. So the alpha is on the carcass first, and he decides, you know, this is mine. Well, two of the mid-ranking wolves were watching him, and he wouldn't let them near this little carcass. And it was as if they were working out a football play. The two mid-ranking wolves were quietly whining and looking at each other and slowly moving around the alpha. And it is as if they had worked out their own plan that they were going to get this. And what one wolf did, it came in, grabbed a piece of fur, which of course made the alpha turn around and go after him. While the alpha went after the one wolf, the other mid-ranking wolf came in, grabbed a leg, ran off with that, and then the alpha had to turn around and go after him, and then the other mid-ranking wolf came in and grabbed the rest of it. So it was this great little tease they had going on, and the alpha kind of playfully chased them, and it was like, ugh.
Well, one of the things that we share, I, like you, believe that these animals have extremely complex emotions and perceptions that, yes, it is similar to our own as humans. But, you know, the truth is, and I, both as a scientist and as just an observer, a person, I happen to know that dogs, for example, which I've had real experience with, absolutely understand me, read me. They know my feelings, my emotions. If they feel that I'm suffering, they come over and they lick your face. If you're angry around someone, they intervene in a very aggressive ways. And I suppose maybe historically, you know, humans are not individual hunters as much as they are as well. Historically, pack animals, you know, we would hunt together, and perhaps a lot of these very similar behaviors and dynamics have kind of followed parallel paths of development.
Oh yeah, you can easily see when you watch wolves and dogs how early man and early Native Americans really learned a lot from watching wolves, from watching their cooperative hunting, watching the way they have cooperative families, and taking that on. And so you can see this bond. We need each other. Wolves need each other. And, you know, so when wolves were eventually taken in and domesticated, you know, we became the pack.
Some of the emotion that we started to notice right at the beginning of the project occurred with the very first Omega. And this Omega was very good at instigating play. You know, she was picked on, and because she was picked on, she would try to go off by herself. But as a pack member, she still would try to change the subject by getting the wolves into a game of tag. Well, because she got picked on so often, she would often go off by herself. And at one time, a mountain lion got into our territory and climbed the fence and killed this Omega wolf.
Hmm.
Now, what I want to point out here is not how this happened, but how the pack reacted to the death of this Omega. For the next 6 weeks, and they would play all the time, this pack stopped playing.
Hmm.
They would just mope around. They weren't interested in any kind of game at all. And their howling changed. Normally, wolves howl to sort of galvanize their solidarity. And the howl is full of yips and whines, and they're very excited when they howl, and they howl as a group. After the Omega died, they stopped howling, and they only would howl separately and in a very lonely way, as if they were trying to call this one wolf back.
Mm-hmm.
In the wild, we have heard reports from biologists that have found a skeleton of a wolf that had broken its jawbone. Now, the jawbone healed, and the wolf went on to live many more years, but it must have been that the pack had kept that wolf alive by bringing back food and regurgitating it. And so that we see this compassion throughout the natural world. In Yellowstone, wolves have suffered broken legs or even been trapped and continue on with the pack. Well, they would never have been able to bring down animals by themselves. it must have been the pack that kept them alive.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it takes a lot for a pack. It would be much easier to leave the wolf. But they, you know, they are a member of the family, and they are taken care of.
You mentioned that these wolves now are a captive pack. They're enclosed because they can't be released. But when you go to visit them, they still recognize you, which to me is making the point that they do have a sense of individuality, and they have a memory and a connection with individuals, that it, such that when one is lost, they feel that.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it's no more different than, you know, you hear stories about dogs whose masters have, or companions have passed away, and, you know, the dog lays under the bed and, you know, won't get up, and, you know, another family member tries to take it, and it just gets depressed and doesn't eat. I mean, the wolves are very emotional, and they do recognize, you know, individuals, and each of our wolves were clearly individuals, and all taken care of by each other.
Well, we're going to take a break. We're talking with Jim and Jamie Dutcher, who have a book and movie out, Living with Wolves. So when we return, we're going to take a look at kind of another side of this, the emotional and intelligence of wolves. So we'll be right back.